From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today we hear from the Senate Majority Leader on Flint water crisis issues.
The lead and copper rule, I know the governor wants to try to do some things with that, but again, we don't feel that caused the problem. I don't think that's one of them we're going to consider.
We revisit some Trump supporters to see what they think 100 days into his presidency.
He's acting like a businessman, and I think he's being very professional.
Graduation ceremonies mark University of Michigan's 200th anniversary.
Name another institution that's been doing so well for 200 years. Actually, there aren't that many.
And Northern Michigan holds its first LGBT prom.
I think having a prom like this really gives them a safe space and a place to come and kind of express themselves and be who they want.
Plus, we have an Artisan of Michigan feature and Ken Sikkema and Vicki Barnett. Whew, that's a lot. All starts right after the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Here's what we've got for you today. We'll check in with two Trump supporters and ask them how they think President Trump has done during his first 100 days in office. Also, did you know the University of Michigan was founded 20 years before the state was even a state? We'll talk about the U of M bicentennial. Plus, we'll have another Artisan of Michigan to tell you about. Those stories and more coming up this hour. But first, this week marked the third anniversary of the beginning of the Flint water crisis. Following the orders of a state-appointed emergency manager, Flint switched its water supply from Detroit water to water from the Flint River. There were problems. Lots of problems. The primary result was lead contamination of the water. The state denied the problem for a long time. It wasn't until activists and news media proved there was a problem that the state finally did something. This week, the state Senate passed a supplemental appropriations bill which included federal dollars for Flint, $100 million. Joining us now is Republican Majority Leader of the Senate, Arlen Meekhoff. So what yet needs to be done to make Flint and its people whole again?
Well, I've worked very closely with Senator Ananick on a few things, and we got a couple more things that we didn't finish up last year that we're working on, including with some assistance programs, some of the resources with health and things like that. We have an idea that Senator Ananick has put forward about a promise zone, and we're going to revisit that here very shortly. And I just think assure them that their local government seems to be working better. They got agreement from the EPA, the DEQ, and the mayor's office about how they should handle their water. And then, while it's not over, it is certainly much improved from 3 years ago.
You mentioned Senator Jim Ananick. He was on the show this week, and one of the things he'd like to see is the repeal of the law that allows an emergency manager. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, we have some ideas after the bicameral report that came out. Maybe putting something together that it doesn't empower just one person. Maybe it's a panel, but that's going to be handled in committee, and we'll have some very vigorous debate about it, I'm sure.
I was reviewing the report of the Joint Select Committee on the Flint Water Emergency, and that committee made a lot of recommendations, about 30 of them, including Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention and Control Committee, strengthening the state lead and copper rule, better blood level screening for children. The list goes on. What do you plan to do with those recommendations?
Well, I'll just start with the lead copper rule because that lead copper rule did not cause the problem there. Actually, people with gross negligence, human error, that's what caused the error. So,
but it revealed that there is the potential problem because the federal level might be too high.
No, what it revealed is the federal testing had so many holes in it that you could negate what really was in the test. So the rule isn't the problem. It wasn't the problem. It didn't cause the problem. So the negligence and human error did.
Well, what about these other things that the Select Committee recommended? You mentioned about two of them when we were talking earlier. There are 30 of them, as I mentioned. Are you considering any of those?
Yeah, we still are considering them. But the lead and copper rule, I know the governor wants to try to do some things with that. But again, we don't feel that caused the problem. And so I don't think that's one of them we're going to consider.
I keep hearing the phrase Flint fatigue in reference to the legislature's willingness to continue to help Flint recover from this disaster. There will be lasting effects because of the damage to the neurological systems of the children. How will the state ensure these kids get the support necessary to overcome what this man-made disaster did to them?
Yeah, well, let me back up and just say we don't know if there's neurological problems, but what we were able to do, this is the part of the story that most of the media misses. The people in this state were so generous, and people around this country were so generous sending in water for their fellow Americans and Michiganians that were in trouble, that we were able to refocus the money that the state was spending, over $200 million, much of it going into tracking the health of these children so that if there are issues in the going forward, there's at least a baseline, and we have knowledge of what was their baseline exposure, and if there's health issues, we then can move from there. So we've done a lot of things, and you mentioned that we just moved $100 million. So the federal government took them 3 years to send us something. We started as soon as we actually knew that we were at risk, at least here in the Senate. And we spent, and not that the spending makes a difference, but I think we've implemented the things in Flint with $200 million that are making a difference.
I know the budget's for next fiscal year is not set yet. What kind of help for Flint and its kids do you expect to be in the state budget?
I haven't seen the DHHS budget yet, but I know there was a lot of discussion around what continued need to be done to track health of children there so we don't lose track of them. And again, if there's potential for health issues in their future, we want to make sure we know what the base is.
What about other cities that might be at risk for too high of lead levels?
Yeah, we have aging infrastructure, and there are places that have lead levels, including some of my community, but they make sure they monitor and treat them appropriately. And at some point, we're going to have to move. How do we do this better? And I don't think we have all the answers to that yet.
Arlen Meekhoff is the majority leader in the Michigan Senate. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little more about that supplemental appropriations bill. Joining me are Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate, and Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken, that joint select committee, which made those recommendations to fix Flint and avoid another Flint, what do you think about the legislature taking so little action on those recommendations?
Well, I think you have to give credit where credit is due, right? In terms of the legislature and the governor. They have stepped up to the plate with financial assistance. I think the what they haven't done yet is what you've mentioned, and that is there are recommendations out of their own special committee dealing with the statewide implications of what happened in Flint. For example, more aggressive screening of blood lead levels in children. That hasn't yet been done. Looking at the lead and copper rule, I would disagree a little bit with Majority Leader Meekhoff in terms of that federal rule. I think it's very ambiguous. Changes to the emergency manager law, looking at statewide water infrastructure problems. All of those were actually recommendations in their own committee that they haven't yet acted on.
Vicki, Senate Majority Leader Meekhoff doesn't think the state should have stricter regulations on lead levels. And as he mentioned, the governor wants it. Health officials say there is no safe lead level, but less is better. What do you think of Senator Meekhoff's reasoning that the lead levels weren't part of the problem?
Well, he's correct. The lead levels were not part of the problem. But now that we've learned that the lead levels are still too high by federal standards, it makes sense to start to correct that and test going forward based on the lower lead levels or as low as possible. There are problems with infrastructure across the state, as Ken mentioned, and we already know that we have lead issues in drinking water in some of our older schools, and we're trying to address that as best we can. But most communities have been gutted by revenue sharing cuts and really can't afford to fix the problems that they're suffering under.
I want to ask you both now, let's make it clear, none of us is a scientist as we're talking here, but the majority leader talked about establishing a baseline of data on the kids. But if that was done after they'd already been exposed to lead, how is that going to be helpful in the future?
It's not. That's the real problem. We already know what a healthy kid looks like. Let's use that as the baseline and recognize that thousands of children were poisoned in the Flint water switch, and the state is going to be on the hook for that, not to mention the Legionnaire's disease and the problems resulting from that. But Flint is just one problem that shows how dangerous our failure to address our infrastructure is, not only on the health, safety, and welfare of communities, but directly on the bodies of children.
Ken?
I think he was a little unclear. What he was talking about is a recommendation from both the Flint Water Advisory Task Force and the Special Legislative Committee to create a registry in Flint of children. All children who were in Flint of a certain age or between a certain age during the time they were drinking the lead-exposed water so you could track their health over a period of time. That is an essential thing that has to be done that basically everybody has recommended. That's what he was referring to in terms of establishing.
Fair enough. $3 million was approved by the legislature yesterday to help Macomb County fix that big sinkhole in Fraser. Ken, should the legislature be putting money into infrastructure repairs like this?
Well, I think that the common theme here in both Flint and the Fraser sewer issue is both the legislature in Michigan and the federal government are providing one-time grants, which is okay. But in both cases, it's kind of a one-time appropriation versus a sort of systemic long-term approach to the statewide problem. That's still kind of out there that has to get, I think, addressed in terms of water infrastructure and dealing with that statewide. You can't solve these problems with just one-time appropriations. You need a systemic approach that has a funding scheme.
Vicki, that sinkhole is in your neighboring county. What do you think of this situation? Is a one-time grant going to fix this, or as Ken says, we need to really look at this systemically?
I think we need to look at this systemically. Let's take a look real quickly at the Fraser sinkhole. That's a $150 million problem. The $3 million that was just appropriated as a grant was found left over in some unused road funding by MDOT. And the money was then taken and granted to Macomb County so that they could create a bypass to deal with the raw sewage problem while they're fixing this sinkhole. But the whole problem there is still $150 million. And when we're talking about major infrastructure problems like the Flint water crisis and the Fraser sinkhole and a major sinkhole that we have right now in Southfield near Telegraph Road, we're talking about millions and billions of dollars. And one-time fixes aren't going to solve the problem. We need to create a robust fund on an ongoing basis to collect money to fix these infrastructure problems and do maintenance and repair on an ongoing basis so that we don't let our infrastructure crumble. These are dangerous problems. All we need is we're just a step away from one major bridge collapse where hundreds of people can be killed. This is not a laughing matter. This is a very serious problem. We have neglected our infrastructure for the last generation, and we have to start to fix it.
That's Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. We also heard from Ken Sikkema. He's senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican leader in the state Senate. He joined us by Skype. Thanks, both of you. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In some schools in Michigan, being a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or questioning high school student is welcomed, embraced. In other schools, LGBTQ kids have to stay in the closet or endure a backlash from homophobic students or even teachers and administrators. Prom can be an especially difficult time. Taking a same-sex date or dressing in a way which expresses their gender identity instead of the gender at birth is not always accepted. This year, in fact, this weekend in Traverse City, there will be what's being called a queer prom. LGBTQ high school students and their allies are being invited to the prom. Joining us to talk about that are John Young, board member of Polestar LGBT Center of Traverse City, and Eamon McGonigal, sophomore at Traverse City West Senior High School. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Eamon, let's start with you. Why is an LGBTQ prom necessary?
Well, I think for people, kind of like what you said, for some people, the support is not always there, and that can be at many different schools. I know the school that I go to is really supportive, but there are other schools in the area and probably just in Michigan in general who don't necessarily provide that atmosphere of support for their students, especially those who are LGBT. And I think having a prom like this really gives them a safe space and a place to come and kind of express themselves and be who they want.
Now, this isn't a blanket statement, but I've been told that some private schools, some rural schools, are less welcoming and certainly will be less welcoming to a prom. It's more of an issue. Why is that?
I think sometimes it's just not as much of a community there, and it's kind of a smaller population. So maybe it's harder to get those ideas, not ideas, just the awareness of where the need is in those kind of rural communities.
Eamon, you said that Traverse City West Senior High is welcoming. Are you still going to attend prom there as well as the queer prom?
Yes, I will. I'm going with a group of friends this year and probably will attend for the next 2 years also for the rest of my high school.
John Young, take a moment and tell us about Polestar LGBT Center.
Polestar we're a group of people that are in the process of fundraising to open the first LGBTQ community center in Traverse City. We've been working for about a year now, started with a needs assessment, and it became evident that there really is a need and a want for a community center in Traverse City. So we're very excited. We're probably about 2 months away from opening up.
What's your group's role with the prom?
Part of the process of opening a community center is to find out what people wanted. And I really went around the country visiting different community centers. And one of the things in youth programming that really excited me was a prom. So I reached out to the coordinator at TC West, and we started talking. Both got very excited about putting on a prom for all the high schools up here. So there is going to be 27 high schools that are going to be represented at this prom. We expect about 100 people.
Wow, that's a lot of response. I understand there's a benefactor who's subsidizing part of the cost of Northern Michigan's first queer prom. Tell me about that.
Yeah, Jeff Jenkins reached out. I believe, and Eamon can correct me, but I believe his sister is a teacher at TC West.
Yes.
He mentioned that he wanted to fund this thing. So he's funded this prom 100%. He's out of Los Angeles and is a producer there.
Eamon McGonigal, John just mentioned 27 schools. How did you get the word out to LGBTQ students who might be from rural high schools or don't have the network of allies in the way that you do?
I think not only just spreading the message on like social media, but getting posters out there, getting people talking about it, talking to your friends about it, kind of getting the awareness out there that this is going on. I know Jeff sent posters to all the surrounding schools to put up, and I think that has really helped get that kind of awareness that this event is going on and that they are 100% invited.
And we also reached out to all the counselors of all the high schools in the area. So they've been spreading the word, even if they can't put posters up, because most of these rural high schools, they would not put up the posters.
Hmm. So I've got one really important question to ask both of you. What's the theme of the prom?
We chose this year, not we, the students on the prom committee chose not to have a theme. So it's just going to be a rainbow theme.
Yeah, well, that is a theme though, isn't it?
Yeah, just kind of a general, I guess, LGBT theme, kind of acceptance, just as the first one, just to kind of kick it off with what it really means.
Well, Eamon, I hope you and your fellow students have a great time there. Eamon McGonigal is sophomore at Traverse City West Senior High School. John Young is board member at Polestar LGBT Center of Traverse City. We've been talking about Northern Michigan's first queer prom. That's Saturday, 7 to 11 at Hotel Indigo in Traverse City. Thanks for talking with us about this.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Do you remember Dolly the sheep? She was the first cloned mammal. There were concerns about Dolly because the cell used to clone her was from a 6-year-old sheep. Dolly died young, and the conclusion at the time was that Dolly more or less was born at 6 years of age, same age as the cell. But cloning research has continued since the announcement of Dolly in 1997. Here to talk about that is Jose Cibelli. He's a professor of animal biotechnology at Michigan State University, and he joins us via Skype. There have been more mammals cloned since Dolly. What have we learned about cloning?
Well, it's been 2 decades since the announcement of Dolly, the cloned sheep. There have been a number of animals cloned. I would say that we never thought it would be so many different species. Actually, more than 20 different species have been cloned using the same technique. Everything from camels to rabbits to rats to fish. It's not that complicated. But there's a few other things that we're still not sure about how they work.
Let's talk about one of those things. Tell me why telomeres matter.
Oh, yeah, the telomeres is just the DNA that is at the end of each chromosome. We need those caps at the end, so every time the cell will divide, we don't unwind all the DNA and lose the DNA from the chromosome. So we have extra chromosome at the end, but that extra chromosome is not being added on in animals while they're adults. It's only added on in a few cells, like, for example, the cells in the germ cells or some type specific stem cell in the blood. But in general, adult tissue don't generate these caps at the end. So that's why that was one of the ways that they use when Dolly was born to measure, try to figure out how old she was.
Because that cap was shorter, as I understand it, which actually meant that she might live a shorter life, correct?
Correct. The level of resolution that we had at the time to measure the length of telomeres in Dolly was not the most, I guess, sophisticated. We now can do it much better. And so we had to rely on a semi-quantitative way of measuring. And the conclusion was, it was a paper published in Nature at the time, was that Dolly had shorter telomeres. And they predicted that Dolly would actually die younger. And that was the case, even though she died for other causes that were not related to aging. But there were two camps. The people that thought that clones would live a shorter life, and those in a different camp, in which I'm included, that we were trying to prove that that was not the case, that if you clone the animals properly, you can actually have a normal lifespan.
Let's fast forward. The man who introduced Dolly to the world passed away. You were a friend. You went to visit his wife. What'd you learn there?
Right. Dolly was cloned by Keith Campbell and Ian Wilmot. Those are the two main investigators and a group of scientists at the Roslin Institute. The senior investigator is Ian Wilmot. He's still alive. Keith Campbell passed away in 2012. And what I found that was actually very interesting, because Keith was also convinced that the animals will actually live a normal lifespan. And to prove it, he decided to clone multiple Dollies. So he decided to use the same original cell line that was used to generate Dolly the clone sheep and cloned several of them. So I think there were a total of 11 sheep. Five of them were Dollies, and then were another four or five that were cloned from sort of like a control group. And Keith's wife showed me this picture of the Dollies that were absolutely normal. And they were, by the time that the picture was taken, were 9 years old. So they already have outlived Dolly by 3 years. And I knew what that meant. What it meant is that, yes, these animals can live a normal life. And sure enough, we got last year, towards the end of last year, there was the scientific paper showing all the physiological parameters of this sheep that were perfectly normal. They didn't have any early onset aging signs. In fact, they were actually living quite a long life. But for a sheep, some were 10, 11 years old. That was proving the point. For me, it's important that we settle the issue now. We know that if you clone animals, they're going to live a normal life if you do it properly. But this mystique about cloning continues, because we know now that you can take a cell from an animal that is 6 years old. And we also did it in cows that were even older. And when you take the nucleus of that cell from an old animal and you put it into an oocyte or into an egg, then the egg will reset the biological clock.
So why all the research on cloning through the years? What are the implications for medical or husbandry? What are we looking for? What do we hope to gain by all of this?
Well, the applications are in multiple fields. You can have agriculture for preservation of animal species, dissemination of animals with high genetic merit. This is something that will continue for many years to come, because you can now produce highly sophisticated genetic modifications in animals and then clone them. You can do biomedical research. You can create animal models to study human disease. But perhaps the most striking one is that was the demonstration that you can take a cell that is already committed to one tissue and bring it back and be able to make all the tissues in the body. And that was good enough to show that you can make stem cells using a particular procedure now that we call iPS cells.
Are you saying we can clone organs?
Well, we're pretty close. There are groups now working on making animals that will eventually be capable of making organs that are 100% human. So you could have a pig, for example, that is engineered to have all the organs but the liver or pancreas. And then the only cells that will make the pancreas are cells from a patient that will need that. So these are experimental step right now, but they're working pretty well in animal models. So I'm aware of at least two groups that are already working with pigs to try to make that work.
How much time do you think will go by before we actually do that and it's actually being used by the medical industry?
Well, the pressure is really high. More than 70% of the patients that are in a waiting list for organs in the U.S., they never received the organs. So the pressure, the need is huge, and the technology is available. We still have to figure out some things, for example, from the regulatory point of view, but this shouldn't take more than 2 or 3 years to have it at least working at the level of having the organs prepared. From there to get through the approval process, perhaps it will take longer.
As a layperson, I keep thinking, wow, what are the ethical concerns? What should we worry about? I mean, what could possibly happen? I mean, will we start cloning humans for their particular attributes? The possibilities seem almost unlimited once the technology is revealed. And then we've got all these ethical questions, right?
Right. Well, that for sure is something that society will have to debate very seriously, because then we're talking about two different things. One is health and trying to bring people a better quality of life. The other one is almost an enhancement. It's something that you just don't really need it, but since it's available, some people may want to take advantage of it. So those are the two things that society will have to decide, but for sure it's coming.
Wow. That's Jose Sibeli. He's a professor of animal biotechnology at Michigan State University and the author of the article, More Lessons from Dolly the Sheep: Is a Clone Really Born at Age Zero? It was published by The Conversation. Professor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've been on the road again, talking to craftspeople in a series we're calling Artisans of Michigan. We are on a residential street in Highland Park. That's a city within the city of Detroit.
You don't pull too hard because it's going to tear.
I'm watching Celeste Smith make a hat, a fancy one.
I'm going to put a couple tats in here.
She says she's been up all night long working on her hats for her company, Celeste Couture Hats.
I'm getting ready for the Derby. They're having the Detroit Derby Day here, and then I also have some clients that go to Louisville. That big one that you're seeing on the table down there, that's for one of my clients. And so I've been like getting that ready. So May 6th is the big day.
Smith says the Kentucky Derby is always a busy time, but since she moved her business from Los Angeles to Highland Park, she stayed pretty busy. She's not making hats for movies anymore. It's a different clientele, but she's learning who's likely to be interested.
The church women, they will spend a little bit more, and they like elaborate hats.
Celeste Smith says she started out a long time ago making bridal veils. Then she started working with Hollywood costume designer Rita Riggs.
My business started taking off, and I start working with Rita. And I start, you know, making hats for her, different film work. And I loved doing working in the film industry because it's seeing the work going across the screen and then also seeing your name on the credit was kind of like, wow, did I do that? That was fun.
She even had time to study millinery in Europe. But then her mom got sick and she came back to Highland Park to care for her. After her mom passed away, instead of moving back to L.A., Celeste Smith decided to stay. Because of the kids, her neighbors.
And the kids just love me. When they see me, Miss Celeste, I always say, call me Miss Celeste. And they come in here and they want to see what I'm doing.
So she called Rita Riggs in Los Angeles.
So when I started seeing that, I thought, you know what? I'm not going to come back just yet. I said, I think there's something here and I'm going to see. I want to work with it and see.
So it's Celeste Couture Hats in Highland Park for the time being. Our latest Artisan of Michigan. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Tomorrow is graduation day at the University of Michigan, and this year the university celebrates its bicentennial. Now, think about that. A public university was established in Michigan 20 years before Michigan was even a state. Here to talk about those early days is Terry McDonald. He's a professor of history and the director of the Bentley Historical Library at the University of Michigan. So this story doesn't begin in Ann Arbor. It begins in Detroit. What influenced the university's founders to even attempt something like this and what was basically then the frontier?
The American Congress, before the Continental Congress, before the American Constitution actually passed a bill in 1787 called the Northwest Ordinance, which was designed to organize the states, which was then thought to be the Old Northwest, including Michigan and Ohio and Illinois and others. And in that bill was included funding for education in all of those areas. So the federal government had made the federal lands available for sale to support all levels of education. And so in the early 19th century, Michigan's territorial governor decided to open up a school system and to some extent starting with the university at the top.
So was there a model for a public university? I mean, we had Harvard and some of the other Ivy League schools, but did we have public universities at that time?
Almost all the universities existing in the country at that time were not only private but religious. So the idea of establishing a public, non-secular university was quite unique.
So there's this concept of a university in Detroit, but it doesn't get off the ground right away. The town, the city, is really not that big. It's 5,000 people in Detroit at the time. No public schools are even a model for that. So what was elementary and high school like, and what was the role of this early version of the University of Michigan in Detroit?
Well, the main thing about college in the early 19th century was that in order to be admitted to most colleges and universities had what was called the classical curriculum, which was basically embedded in the ancient languages of Greek and Latin. So to present yourself for admission to college, you had to know those languages before you could come. Not surprisingly, this cut down the demand. The number of freshmen who are eligible in any area who could actually use those languages. And in Michigan, you had a very, very busy frontier kind of setting, and so very few people could actually present the required curricula, the required prereqs necessary to be admitted.
So how did that affect the founders and their plans for a university in Detroit?
The founders, who were very interesting, a Catholic priest named Gabriel Richard and a Protestant minister called Richard Monteith, both of whom were fluent in all these languages. Most of the most highly educated people in America in the early 19th century, in fact, were clergy. They completely designed a classical curriculum university, which they expected to be organized around the classical languages, but also that had 13 other disciplines, economics, anthropology, all kinds of other things. They had a very, very broad idea of what a university should contain, and they were to be the first two professors.
Now, the idea of a public school, a public college at that time, didn't necessarily mean tax-supported like it does today. They didn't call it tuition either. They called it subscription. Tell me the difference between tuition and subscription.
The citizens of Detroit in 1817, in a relatively short period of time, in the summer of 1817, actually put up $5,000 to actually open the university. But in the long run, it was funded by the sale of federal lands in the territory of Michigan. And so those were the two streams of income.
So it was subsidized quite a bit.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where was this University of Michigan located in Detroit?
On Bates Street. There's a parking ramp there now and a historical marker on it. Relatively nondescript two-story building. You know, it was not expensive to build, and you wouldn't have necessarily thought it was a very unique kind of a place when it opened up.
And it was used for quite a while, a couple of decades, right?
It was used for a couple of decades, but there were no collegiate courses offered. The closest it came was as kind of a college prep place. But for the most of that time, it ultimately was used by the Detroit Public Schools.
I want to play a little bit of something for you. This was aired on WUOM, our flagship station, 50 years ago for the sesquicentennial.
Fill your tankards deep with wine. Drink a health to Michigan. In that sparkling flood divine. Drink a health to
To the Cornflower and the Maize, a series of programs marking the 150th anniversary of the University of Michigan.
I love that announcer's voice. That was the idea of a true radio professional back there. So that gets us to Ann Arbor. When and why did the University of Michigan move from Detroit to Ann Arbor?
Well, when Michigan was admitted to the Union in 1837, the state legislature basically began kind of reauthorizing everything. And so they passed a bill reestablishing the University of Michigan, and they opened up a competition among cities to apply to have it located there.
I was just in Jackson recently, There were three things that cities in Michigan wanted more than anything else: the university,
that's right,
a prison,
that's right,
or to be the state capital.
That's right. I'm sure at the time it was thought to be a bit of a booby prize. The Ann Arbor Land Company, which was a group of land speculators who were trying to encourage people to come to Ann Arbor and therefore make their land more valuable, actually encouraged the location of this of the university in Ann Arbor by offering the 40 acres, which of course is the diag in the central campus area. And one of the early historians of the university claims they also spread shares in the Ann Arbor Land Company through the state legislature to help make sure the vote went the right way.
Okay. Those early days in Ann Arbor, how many students, how many professors were at the school when they first opened here?
Well, there were four faculty members, all of whom were ordained ministers, and there were I think a grand total after a little bit of about eight students, I think six freshmen, two sophomores.
Wow. The University of Michigan is celebrating its bicentennial at graduation ceremonies tomorrow. We've been speaking with Professor of History and the Director of the Bentley Historical Library at the University, Terry McDonald. So how should we properly celebrate the 200th anniversary of University of Michigan?
I think that an important way to think about this is name another institution that's been doing so well for 200 years. Actually, there aren't that many. It's quite a remarkable record of accomplishment and not just duration, but incredible success over that time period. Michigan rapidly became one of the most important universities in America, certainly was such by the middle of the 19th century, and has been ever since.
Thanks very much for coming in. We here at Stateside want to hear from you. What stories are bugging you? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. And, of course, at michiganradio.org, just click the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. After the election, we talked to a few Donald Trump supporters and asked about their vote. We're at the first 100 days of the Trump presidency and wanted to check back in, visit those Trump supporters again. Dr. Michael Basuito is a plastic surgeon and sits on the Wayne State University Board of Governors. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So when we last talked, you predicted President Trump would be different than candidate Trump and that he'd, quote, change course. Do you think he has?
Yeah, I think he has. I think, as you can see, he's negotiating. He's acting like a businessman, and I think he's being very professional.
You said you thought Trump was tough, and that was exhibited through how he dealt with the news media. Since that point, he's continued to accuse many of the major news operations of being fake news and called the news media, quote, the enemy of the American people. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that we've got a major problem that's developed in the news nowadays. I think we have our news programs that are editorial programs and our news programs that are news programs. And I think we have too many news people who are becoming editorialists. And I think that the news media is losing the confidence of the people.
You told us you listened to a mix of different outlets. You've listened to the Russian news outlet Pravda, as well as Fox and MSNBC. What have you learned from your sources about the president?
I think this has been a real roller coaster because on occasion, I've been listening to MSNBC, and I've been hearing MSNBC applauding Trump and bashing Barack Obama in certain instances. And I've heard instances where Fox has applauded Obama for certain things he's done and has bash Trump, and they're all over the place. But I don't think that's necessarily bad.
One of the big concerns, of course, is this investigation into a possible Russia-Trump campaign collusion. What do you make of that?
I think it's nonsense. You heard a lot of people were squawking about a potential connection, and then Trump had Syria bombed, which was definitely against Putin's wishes, I'm sure, and you heard all those people were silent and went away. You didn't hear anything about it after that.
How would you rate the job he's done so far?
I would give him an A.
I was looking at some of the priorities he outlined and then how much success he's had with them. So bear with me just a little bit. President Trump, first ban on immigrants from several Muslim countries, that was blocked by the courts. His second attempt at banning immigrants from several Muslim countries was blocked by the courts. He said he'd repeal and replace Obamacare, and that's not happened. His administration threatened to withhold federal dollars from so-called sanctuary cities, and now the courts are blocking that. And he's having a tough time persuading Congress to fund building the wall between the U.S. and Mexico. So how should we view those unfulfilled plans by the Trump administration?
Well, if you look at it, all those court decisions that were blocked were blocked by the Ninth Circus of Appeals,
And I don't think that's surprising anybody. And I agree with Trump when he said, see you at the Supreme Court. If you look at the record that the Ninth Circuit has had with respect to reversals, I think you're going to see everything reversed there. These are all activist judges. So I think that's a foregone conclusion, in my opinion. In terms of the wall, I think he said it's going to get done. It'll get done. But, you know, if you look at it, for instance, in getting, you mentioned Obamacare. I'm not at all upset by the fact that the Republicans couldn't come to an agreement to get this passed first time around, because it should be discussed at length. It should be mashed over. It should be, there should be compromise. There should be discussions with the Democrats. It should be bipartisan.
If you had to do it all over again, would you still back Donald Trump as a president?
Yes.
Yep. And what could he do that would lose your trust or your support?
Oh, I think that if he lied about something in terms of, you know, if he said he was going to, if he proposed something that turned out to be a lie, I think that's one of the things that would be hard to go back on in terms of if he lost me for doing that, it'd be hard to get me back.
That's Dr. Michael Basuto. He's a plastic surgeon and sits on the Wayne State University Board of Governors and a Trump supporter. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Let's turn to another Trump supporter we talked to earlier this year, just before the inauguration. Renee White is joining us via Skype. She's a substitute teacher from Manistee and voted for Donald Trump. How do you think President Trump has done during the first 100 days?
I think he's done a tremendous job. I think he's outdone what I thought he could do.
He's changed his position on some issues. What do you think of those reversals?
I don't think they're bad. I think, you know, when you get into office, and remember, he wasn't a politician. But I think once he got into office, you know, new things were discovered. I think the world's a lot worse than we thought it was. I think a lot more things are unfolding. So I think he had to change his position on some things. But I think he showed a strong stance on it and has done a tremendous job.
When we talked earlier this year, you said you felt your kids would now have a better future. What has President Trump done as of yet to help make your kids' future better?
Well, the new tax rollout will save them tremendous. If that goes through, that's wonderful. Their 401ks have increased tremendously. They've both gotten raises because of the economy turning around a little bit. Their production going out has done tremendous. Two of the kids just got higher positions than what they had. So I've seen a huge turnaround already, a huge turnaround.
What has President Trump done so far that's impressed you the most?
I'm going to say the fight that he's doing for the VA, only because I have a husband who's in the VA and who needs medical attention a lot. I think the turnaround that he's done with the VA, the fact that I could take him to UH Hospital if I want to now versus going to, you know, the VA here or whatever, I think that's a tremendous thing. I like that. I wish the travel bans would have went through. I think that would help us a lot. You know, they didn't because of opposition, but...
Well, it's because of the courts that it was unconstitutional, but why do you think that that's necessary?
Why do I think that it's necessary? Because I right now live in a city who wants to put sanctuary cities in. I don't want to be any part of that. I don't think that that's right. I think that crossing the border is broken a line, and I think that that's against the law, just the same as me speeding or anything else. I think that they need to go through the proper channels in order to get here. And I think that we need to screen. I think that's a very important thing to do. I mean, look at all the other countries and all. I mean, we have enough terrorism going on here. I'd hate to be in Sweden or France or London.
As you mentioned, President Trump, before getting in office, was not a politician. And in an interview with Reuters News Service, Mr. Trump indicated the job of president is a lot harder than he thought it would be. What does that tell you about his perceptions of the job beforehand?
You know, there's a business aspect to it that I think that he's invoked in it. But I think, you know, there was a little bit more along the lines of dealing with politicians that, you know, it's on a whole nother level when you're in with them than trying to get them to help you on the outside. You know, we have a lot of Democrats, a lot of opposition going on. Man, we could have done so much more in these first 100 days had there not been so much opposition.
Fox News released a poll on Wednesday asking people, if the 2020 election were held today, would you support Donald Trump for re-election or would you vote for someone else? It found that 7% of Trump voters would vote for someone else in 2020. What do you make of that?
I don't know. I know I would have voted for him over and over again. I'll vote for him in the next 4 years, but I don't count the polling as accurate. I mean, look at how it failed on the election day. I mean, it failed miserably.
So you don't think this is a trend among people who supported Trump? You believe that most of them are going to stay behind him and support him until 2020?
Oh, yeah. I think it's just asking a different person, or maybe a person who didn't vote for him in the first place or whatever. I don't think polling can be held accountable through and through. I really don't. I mean, look at the election. Honest and for truly, they really thought Hillary was going to win. I prayed she didn't, and I'm glad she didn't. But, I mean, they were off. They were off tremendously.
Is there anything President Trump could do that would lose your support?
If he wouldn't follow through on his promises, but he's already doing that over and above. I just wish, like I said, that the Democrats wouldn't dig their little heels in.
Renee White is from Manistee, happy with her choice for president after 100 days on the job. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Before we end the show today, I want to tell you about an interview I did that you really don't want to miss. On Monday, here on Stateside, Cynthia Canty will air a talk I had with a woman who explains the cultural issues behind female genital mutilation, sometimes called FGM. Three people have been charged with performing the procedure on minor girls out of a medical office in Livonia.
There are other cultural communities outside of Islam that practice FGM as well. It is really a cultural practice, not a religious practice.
We'll also talk about how common it just might be in the U.S. That's Monday afternoon on Stateside. Today, Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lise Messmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening today. Have a great weekend.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.